this last few nights, I think it was officially last night, full moon. And boy, when it's a full moon out there, that means a lot more daylight you can play with. You know, if it's a, there ain't no much moon out, when it gets dark, it gets dark. When that old moon's full, I can stay out there quite a while. And I had a bunch of beans picked yesterday, and I ain't quite get them all picked. But I got two rows picked, and then I had to tie the rest of my tomatoes. I got some of the prettiest looking tomatoes you've ever
seen. I had to retie mine also. I'm gonna tell you, this looks like it's gonna be the potato year and the potato year and the tomato year and the potato year.
Some of my tomatoes is already hiney high.
Yeah.
It's been relatively dry, which is good because we got that drip tape and we can keep kind of the plant diseases down.
Yep.
And it's been relatively cool still.
Yep.
We got down to 49, I think it was this morning. So I won't say we killed it on absolutely everything, but at least down here in the south. Now, I know those late frost is throwing some of our friends up north for a loop.
Yeah, we had somebody on the Row by Row group post up in Ohio that they had hit their garden planted and they had some frost and they was really concerned about it. So, yeah, I think it's, from what I, you know, last year was a hot May. Y'all remember that? It was
dry,
hot last May. Well, this May seems to be a little cooler, so we're going to have a different year.
Yeah, yeah. We have good years, bad years. For us, at least down here, it looks like it's going to be a pretty good year so
maybe
far.
A little later for our friends up north. Y'all may have to, you know, tweak it a little bit. But we've had some people up north that planted okra 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they called and emailed, and I said, man, you just can't plant an okra in that cool soil. So,
speaking of beans, I want to show you what we got here. Now, this is the first time I've ever grown these. Let me open them up here. These royal burgundy beans. Now, ain't those pretty?
They are pretty. I was going to ask you about those.
They green on the inside, and if supposedly if you cook them, they turn green pretty quickly once you put them in hot water. But I ate a few raw. Tata ate a few raw yesterday, and they're pretty good. Now, they ain't quite as productive as a hybrid. Of course, it is an OP variety. You kind of expect that. I got about
it's got a bold flavor to it, though.
I think it's pretty good raw.
Yeah.
I got about half a 5 gallon bucket off that 30-foot double row yesterday. So we got those. And now those are neat. Now, if you're going to grow those, neat to have. Real
those
pretty.
Those would work good in like a salad.
Yeah. Now, if you just want some home run, just good, solid bush bean production. Now, those of you out there, you may be already picking some. Those of you out there that listen to old Trav, when I said you need to be growing this momentum bush bean, if you're going to grow bush beans, you better get your buckets ready because these rascals right here just loaded up there. When you pull up that bush, you don't have to pick around for them, reach around for them. They just in these huge clusters. You just grab 3 or 4 at a time. So I got a 5 gallon bucket full of those off one 30-foot double row. Yesterday, I still got one more double row to pick. Now, we pick ours pretty small. We don't really actually let the beans inside of them get very big. You really can't even see them. So they don't have a string or anything like that. That's about perfect picking size right there to me.
That's a sweeter bean than this one. Now this is a little more complex flavor to it, maybe due to the color on it, I don't know. That's a good bean, that's got a little sweeter flavor to it.
Yeah, so these are cool. I'd recommend growing these. These are neat, especially if you have kids. They enjoy picking these. These are a little bit easier to see because they're purple. These right here is your home run productive ones there on the momentum. And I think you still got time even down here in the south. You can succession plant these green beans. You can probably still get you a crop of these momentums off if you want.
But you better get them in quick.
Get them in quick.
Well, you know, a lot of people have got their gardens coming in right now. We got squash and cucumbers. My goodness, we got them. And we always trying to find ways to eat them differently. And I don't have a lot of patience. And I love pickles and I love cucumbers. So what Miss Hoss did was she come up with this little recipe here. So you take these cucumbers, or these are the calypsos, because I love growing those calypsos. Which is a pickling cucumber. And she cuts them up long ways. And what she did was put it in a Ziploc bag and put some dill in there and also some elephant garlic. We got dill in the garden and we got elephant garlic.
So dill. What's the liquid in there?
Whoa, you're getting ahead of me a little bit here. Dill and elephant garlic, no water, salt. And that salt draws that moisture out of that cucumber. So you do that, cut them up, put them in there. Now the recipe calls for 3 hours in the Ziploc bag in the refrigerator. We let them sit in there overnight.
So no vinegar.
No vinegar whatsoever. I'm talking about everything here except for the salt we cut out of the garden. So you're talking about healthy, man, this is cat's meow. Now I don't, you know, I am not blessed with a lot of patience for pickles to make for several different days. I love a good pickle, but sometimes I'll be wanting to quit. So she did this right here, and man, it really turned out well. So this is another option for you, for use for those cucumbers. Put your little deal in there, elephant garlic, and just let it sit overnight or 3 or 4 hours. Good stuff.
That's good. Speaking of the pickling process, I was following Miss Wanda over at Deep South. I was posting on her Facebook page all the different steps of making a pickle, soak them in lime. And it can take 3 or 4 days to do that.
There's an art to it.
And they are fine when you know how to do it right. But I don't have the time to follow
it. I enjoy doing it, but I'm like you, it is time restraint. You have to get in the right frame of mind to make pickles. So now, one thing I've noticed about these Calypsos is they are extremely crunchy.
Mm-hmm. And that's a Gynoecious variety. Now, did you trellis them or you just got them on
no,
the ground?
No, these on the ground. I got some slicers that I'm trellising. But these Calypsos was my first planting. And those are bushed out on the ground, making like crazy. I got my succession planting, my second crop, coming along on a trellis.
See, I did the backwards of you. I started off with two rows of slicers. I got Stonewalls and Diomedes coming in right now pretty strong. That I can't really tell a huge difference in production on them yet. They're both pretty tit for tat. Now I've got a row, they only about this tall. They just start to climb the trellis and flower. A row, about a 40-foot row of max packs that I got climbing up that Hortonova trellis. So it won't be long before I have some pickles too. And a succession planting. Speaking of cucumbers, we got a few more in the next few weeks. I got about 20 new varieties of stuff we're going to be adding. A few more squash, cucumbers, gourds, and pumpkins. And the two cucumber varieties I'm going to be adding, one is one that I have grown several years ago that I really, really like. Took me a little while to source it. It's called Olympian.
Yep,
and
I
it's a Gynoecious variety, and it is a dang good one. And then I've got one called Mercury, excuse me.
Now that's a new one on me.
Which is a Parthenocarpic variety.
Ooh, you're throwing some big words on me today.
And
say that one more time.
Parthenocarpic. And we won't dig into that in a whole lot of detail right now, but what it basically means, it's self-pollinating. It doesn't require any pollination. For you, those of you that may, you may live in a city or you may live somewhere you don't have a lot of pollinator activity, that's going to be the one to grow there because you don't need any bees.
Yeah, let's talk about that for just a second here. We won't stay on it long. Joey Bozeman come by this week, got gardens around here close by us, and he's having some problems with squash, and we talked about it, and I said, Joey, I think your problem is pollinators. If you're growing squash and regular cucumbers right now and you're having some issues, probably due to pollination. Pollination is one of the biggest obstacles in growing some of these cucurbits and squashes and all these pumpkins, watermelons, things like that. The fruit set won't be right. They'll rotten right off when they put on fruit. They'll be distorted. It's all kind of issues caused by not having pollinators out there. Now, we both have bees. And I know bees are a little aggravating. Some people don't want to mess with it. But I guarantee it makes a huge difference in those squash and cucumbers. I go out and look in the flower of mine, and I got 3 or 4 bees in there just about all the time. So if you are having problems, you know, it's probably pollination. There's some things you could do there. You can try to draw natural pollinators in there or either step it up and get you some bees. I told Joey, I said, man, if you're going to garden, if you knee deep in this thing, go ahead and get some bees and be done with it. Learn a little bit about them and step out and be done with it. Keep your hive of bees. The normal rate of bees for a garden, well, let me back this up. The normal rate for pollination on commercial farming for watermelons is a hive per acre. Cantaloupes is 2 hives per acre, so I think 1 hive would be fine for the average-sized garden.
Mine's a 1/4 acre. I got 1 hive.
Now, I keep 2 hives. I always keep me a backup hive. I got 2 hives out there now, but I think 1 is fine.
Speaking of squash pollination, so I was watching Danny the other day on YouTube over at Deep South. He was harvesting some gold prize squash, and he had him a mess of it. That's a good one, you know. And he did something I ain't never seen before. He was pruning his squash. And so what his theory was squash, and I got some plants that are almost as big as this table right here, about, you know, 4 or 5 foot tall, some of them. His theory was, if you get too much foliage in there, then bees can't see them flowers and get in there. So he would go and cut a few of them so to make the flowers more visible and accessible, which is, I could see, I understand the theory behind that. Now, my squash plants are doing something this year I haven't never noticed them doing. Maybe they have, I just haven't ever noticed. But in the mornings, in those prime pollinating hours, these big old squash plants, what will they'll do is they'll kind of fold those stems down a little bit and kind of let those flowers show. And then if you go out there late in the afternoon or heat of the day, then it's kind of everything canopies back up. I've never noticed them doing that. But it's kind of like, you know, sunflower will orient towards where the sun is. Those squash plants are kind of showing
the flowers. Yeah, I can see the pruning back if you was really hurting on pollinators. If you got plenty of bees like we do, man, they're going to find it in there. I don't see the need in that if you got plenty. But I guess there's some tricks to do if you don't.
And one more thing about squash, a few more varieties we're adding. We got the eight ball squash, which is the kind of dark green round zucchini. Two more we're bringing on. Same concept, the round zucchini, except these are different color. We got one called cue ball, which is a light green with kind of white specks on it. And then we got one called one ball. You wanna guess what color that is?
White.
You remember what color the one ball is in pool?
White?
No.
Oh, the one ball, I was talking about cue ball. One? That mere pickles got me all confused.
One ball's yeller.
Yeller, okay.
So we got two different kinds, and I kind of want to grow a row and plant a third of each and have me a nice little mixture there. So I'm going to try that. Corn. I got corn knee high, my Avalon sweet corn, about knee high. Now, we talked about how you know when you got enough fertilizer to it. I know I have got enough to mine. I burnt mine back a little bit.
Yeah.
I think what happened, all my rates as far as my applications were pretty good, but I think what happened was I had put a bunch of that compost down there, and sometimes you just can't tell when that compost is going to kind of kick in and convert over. It's
going to spike on you. That's the problem.
But it's not scheduled. You really can't tell when it's going to happen. And what happened was, I think right after I put my Chilean nitrate down, a few days later, some of that compost
ba-boom
kicked in gear, and it burned a little bit of it. Now I laid the water to it the last few nights, and it's back green as a gourd. We're looking good, but that was kind of my signal. Let me know.
Hey, you want that corn as close to that color right there as you can get it. That dark green.
Dark green.
You do that with a combination of nitrogen and MicroBoost. Some of those elements in that MicroBoost will help with that color too. Now your phosphorus and your potassium, all that's not going to help with coloring a whole lot. It's going to help with root development, helping that plant be healthy. But your coloring of that leaf is going to come from nitrogen and a good application of MicroBoost. Boom. Yeah.
Now I might hit mine again in a few more weeks, but I was going to hit it had it not burned back a little bit. I was going to hit it last week, but I saw that happen. I said, whoa, I might have enough for another few weeks there.
You know, my okra slowed down a little bit with these cold nights, and I love me some pickled okra. And we had a viewer of ours, old Brian Bacon from up there at Lake Blackshear, come by last Friday, and he brought me a jar of pickled okra.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened to it, but it's gone.
Well, I'll tell you what happened to it. A bellyache happened to it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't have nothing to eat for lunch one day, and I seen it in there, and it was spicy pickled okra. Now, and I love spicy stuff, but I can't overdo it on spicy stuff. And I sat down there, and I ate.
Did you eat my whole jar?
Now, there's a few. I left you a few plugs in there in the refrigerator so you could try, but I ate almost that whole jar sitting there without a cracker or anything. And it got kind of a little spicy there towards the end, but I like spicy. I got home later that afternoon.
You got wheat?
I had me a little bit of a bellyache. I might have not eat, should not have eat that whole jar.
But that serves you right, missing my pickled okra. If I remember correctly, he said, Greg, I brought you some pickled okra. He didn't say,
no,
Greg
he said,
and Travis.
Make sure you let Travis have some.
So. I don't remember him saying that. But Brian, we appreciate it anyway.
We do. One more thing we got coming up there's a few channels that are involved in this, and I'm not quite sure who organized it all, but it's going to be pretty neat. So between us and a few other YouTube channels, we're having a giant sunflower growing competition. So everybody's going to be growing our variety, which is called the American Giant Hybrid Sunflower. And we're going to let this go on for a few months, and we're going to see who can grow the tallest plant and who can grow the bloom with the biggest diameter.
Are you, will you participating also?
Yeah. So I'm going to, if you want to do your own, you can too. I'm going to plant some in my garden. If you want to do your own, we can have our own little competition within the competition. If you'd like, we can have multiple entries.
Well, y'all a little bit of a disadvantage because I've been doing it longer.
Yeah. But I got a few tricks up my sleeve. As far as these giant, I grew them last year and I didn't get them as big as I wanted, and I know what happened. So, But the channels involved, as far as I know so far, there's one called Four Kids in a Farm, the Naked Hog, who we talked about last week, Adler Farms, we talked about that, them last week, our buddy Jason over at Cog Hill, and I believe Deep South is doing as well. So five or six channels involved there. Should be a fun little, I think we're going to cut it off July. They were asking me when we should let it run to, and I said these things ought to be full size by July 31st. So we're going to let it run till then. A few more things. Somebody's got a big birthday coming up on Sunday. I saw where you got your chair out there.
I did. So the day after last Thursday, which had been Friday, I was out there. Miss Hoss was out there doing some work, and I was out there, and I seen this truck come by. And the fella just kind of stopped and said a few words and went on. I didn't think nothing about it. Well, later on that afternoon, I went out there and seen my chair out in the garden. So I got a good idea who left it out there. He was trying to be, it was one of my neighbors on down the road down there, old man. He was trying to be real sneaky about it. I think he got caught when Miss Hall seen him out there, and she went to question what he was doing. He said, "Oh, I'm just checking things out."
Was he donating the chair or just letting you borrow it?
I don't know, but the chair is mine.
It's still there.
I have confiscated it. He ain't getting it back. So anyhow, I do have me a nice rocking chair.
So if he was joking, he lost a chair.
He lost a chair. I got me a nice rocking chair out in the garden now, and it's going to come in handy.
Good. Good. You'll be 55 on Monday? Sunday. And I'll be 35 by at the end of this month. One of the questions we asked last week, we're 20 years and 20 days apart. It looks like, if the channel keeps growing, it looks like my goal was to hit 100K by the end of the year. It looks like we could hit 100K by the end of this month, which would be an awesome 35th.
That'd be a good birthday present.
So if any of y'all want to give me a good birthday present, just tell everybody you know so we can get this thing to 100K by May 30th. Speaking of the channel growing, I have noticed that as this growth has kind of spiked lately, you get a lot more haters on the channel.
I haven't noticed that.
Get a lot of people on there, I guess, don't really understand the style, everything, and have a lot of people criticizing lately. They say, I talk too much, you know, and they get to the point. Now, we used to do quite...
You talking about on the YouTube comment?
On YouTube, yeah. So we used to do shorter videos.
You know why I don't see them?
You don't have time.
Because I don't look at them.
Yeah. So they say I talk too much, and we kind of went to a longer form video because that seemed to be what everybody wanted. A lot of people complained about my sunglasses.
Yeah, I didn't like them either.
So not just the fact that I wear sunglasses, but like I always say, I like my eyes and I like to take care of them, and recommend you do the same. And then we get a lot of people talking about our bare soil. Just they see that bare soil in the video, and it just drives them crazy. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about today, is no-till gardening, and specifically why we don't.
Look at that thyme right there. That's deal.
So we're going to talk about why we don't do no-till gardening, or the benefits, maybe some not the benefits, and kind of define it. Now we could probably do a whole series of show on this. So this is a pretty deep topic.
It is.
But we're going to try to just stay on the surface a little bit. Because I get a lot of comments, why don't you mulch? Why don't you do no-till? Your soil would be so much better if you do no-till. And I had one guy even the other day ask me why we weren't good stewards of our soil. And so this got me to thinking, you know, we probably should explain to people, we do try to be good stewards of our soil.
Absolutely.
We try to minimize our salt input as much as we can. That's not saying I won't put some salt-based fertilizer out there, but we try to minimize as much as we can using compost and cover crops and stuff like that. So
I think everybody should be good stewards of the land. I mean, if you're gardening, that is your, that's your base right there. You should be good. You should have always be putting forth effort to build your soil, to build that earthworm population, and leave it better than you found it.
That's right. That's right. So before we get into this discussion of why we don't do no-till gardening, and I don't, if you do no-till gardening, don't turn it off right yet, because we're not just going to bash no-till gardening today. That's not what we're here for. We're just going to talk about why it doesn't work for us and why it does work for some other people. First, let's define no-till gardening real quick. Now, there's a lot of misconceptions and terms out there with this. No-till gardening, the way I define it, the way I look at it, really is on two scales. You have the large commercial farmers, like the cotton farmers around here that do no-till gardening. They, in the fall, they once they harvest their crops, they plant a cover crop of rye. They go in, they round up it, they crimp it, or they mow it, and then they come in with a big no-till planter, these huge planters, and plant into it. And that's mainly done for pigweed suppression.
Well, it's done a lot in the South, but it's also done a lot out in the plains area, out Midwest, up north too. They do a lot of no-till, what we call row crop farming, whether it be soybeans, whether it be corn, whether it be cotton. Mm-hmm. They don't grow cotton at Bear River. They do soybeans, they do no-till. Corn, they do a lot of no-till corn.
Well, that, and on that level, it takes a pretty big, sophisticated planter and some tractors to do that. So you've got that end of the scale. And then the other end of the scale is...
Let me back off for just a minute. I'm not aware of any row crop no-till farming that does not include Roundup.
Right. Yeah, I would agree.
Now, there may be some organic farmers out there that's doing it. But I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying I'm not aware of any no-till commercial farming that has to have the input of Roundup in there as part of the plan to work with that type of no-till
farming. Now, I know some small-scale organic farms that crimp and use a drill.
I agree with you. I'm talking about the large row crops.
Right. Cotton, peanut, soybeans, corn, like you said. So there's that end of the scale. And then there's the other end of the scale, which is the very small scale, which does the kind of back to Eden situation where you mulch the entire area, whether it be wheat straw, wood chips, or whatever, and there's no cultivation at all. Now, there's a lot of small to mid-scale market farmers out there that call themselves no-till, but it's not really no-till in my mind. What they do is they don't use a tiller, but what they'll do is they have their little beds designated, they'll top dress them with compost, take something like a wheel hoe, incorporate it in the first inch or two, and plant into that. Yeah, they're not using a tiller, but in my mind, that's not no-till. No-till,
minimal till, maybe.
Yeah, no-till to me means zero cultivation.
Yep.
And that's how we're going to define it going forward on the show today. When we say no-till, we're going to mean zero cultivation. Not even a wheel hoe, nothing. No cultivation. So the first thing I thought about doing a show on this was, let's look up some of the pro no-till people out there. I was looking at a couple different garden bloggers who were pro no-till and see what they say the benefits are of no-till. We can kind of pick that apart and see if we can agree with it. So I just found a garden blog or a couple, and I've got five supposed benefits of no-till out there. And the first one here is that it builds the earthworm population, which is going to promote natural aeration and drainage. And I can't disagree with that one.
I can't either. The drainage thought and the aeration part throws me a little bit there.
Well, the thought process is that the worms have created all these tunnels and holes in the soil that it drains better.
And if you got really good, high organic soils, that may be, but not. What if you're not dealing with that? What if you're building soils and you don't have those type soils
right.
yet?
That takes,
I can't see where that would come into play there on a on a medium type soil that's maybe not where you want it to be yet.
Well, one of the misconceptions is that you can start this no-till and you'll start seeing it takes a long time to build that kind of soil with earthworm, huge populations and stuff like that. It takes a lot of work. It's not a overnight thing.
But I will say that most time, no-till, quote, no-till, is beneficial for the earthworm population.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we would all agree on that. The next one is that it saves water. And this is kind of a no-brainer. If you've got some type of mulch covering over your soil, you're going to reduce the evaporation and save water.
Absolutely.
I don't think we can argue about that. This next one I've got a little bit of qualm with. It reduces or eliminates the need to weed. And this is not really the case for the most part. Several different sources of weeds in your garden. You have weeds that grow up in your garden and they go to seed. That can be a problem. But you've got environmental sources, wind and animals pooping in the garden, bringing in weed seeds. So just because you cover the soil doesn't mean you're going to get rid of all your weeds.
A lot of your weed seed have to have sunlight to germinate. So I think in a no-till situation, you have less weed pressure than you would in a non-no-till weed pressure. But the problem comes in is how you deal with it.
Right. I do think it will, if you just got unbearable weed pressure, I do think it will help that. Now, there are some weeds, and we can talk about this in a minute, that we deal with down here that you're just going to create more problems if you leave an area undisturbed. So it can reduce the need to weed, but it's not going to eliminate it. And depending on what weed you deal with, you might have other problems. The next one is that it saves time and energy. And I'm not 100% convinced on this because it depends on your scale of garden. For me, my quarter acre with my 10 plots, it would be a lot more time consuming for me to go out there and continually apply mulch around my plants and have to remove that mulch every time I replanted and that whole process. A lot of people don't realize down here, we're turning over plots every 30 to 50 days a lot of times. And so, you know, that's a lot of extra legwork to remulch and move mulch and do all that kind of stuff. So I'm not convinced that it saves a whole lot of time and energy.
So let's clarify something here before we get too much further along. So we're talking about annuals versus perennials. We actually do practice no-till with our perennials.
Right, yeah. My blackberry beds, I've got wheat straw on them. It's
we got drip underneath them there. That's no-till as you get. What we're talking about here is annuals, things that grow off quick.
Squash, beans, corn.
One-season crops.
Yeah.
Food sources of vegetables.
And the last supposed benefit of no-till gardening is that it helps retain soil carbon. And that is 100% completely true. When you cultivate the soil, you can smell, you know, that carbon is going in the atmosphere.
Burning up.
So lots of good points there.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I wouldn't completely agree with all five, but all five do have some validity.
They do.
At some point.
They do.
Okay. Now let's talk about, and I came up with these, what I think the benefits of actually cultivating the garden are. And a lot of people will ask on our videos, how do you keep your garden so clean? We believe in what we call frequent shallow cultivation. And that's just going through there and you just, you know, get the weeds when they're small. You're just aggravating that little topsoil layer there. And it's a pretty easy practice once you get the hang of it. Let's talk about some of the benefits. So in my opinion, by cultivating the garden, you can, if you do it right, you can have less weeds and it's easier to weed. If you've got mulch out there, you have to pull them by hand. If you've got, you don't have straw or wood chips, you can what we call mechanically cultivate, like we do with the wheel hoe.
If it's done at the right times and done right.
Right.
If you go in there after a rain, when you get that hard crust buildup, that's where your weed seeds are going to pop through it and keep that dirt cultivated nice and fluffy. Then your weed seeds are not going to have the opportunity to germinate. So you're taking care of a problem before you have a problem there. And once they do start coming up, then you can run through there and they're easier to take care of. If you didn't do proper cultivation on those non-till plots versus a a till plot versus a no-till plot. I think they would be, if you just strictly did by the numbers, I think there'd be less weed pressure in the no-till compared to the till if it's not done correctly.
Right, yeah, I agree. Now there's some weeds, like nutgrass, which we deal with a lot down here. And the only way to get rid of nutgrass is to aggravate the fire out of it.
Or move off and leave it.
Or move off and leave it. Add mulch, because I've talked to customers who've done this. Add mulch, and more mulch. That nutgrass is just going to keep growing through it and growing through it. You can't get rid of nutgrass by covering up. Tarping doesn't really even help with nutgrass unless you go in there and cultivate in between the tarping events. So there's some weeds, specifically we deal with, the repeated cultivation is really the only way to take care of them. So that's something to think about as well. What kind of weed pressure are you dealing with? What kind of species there? The second benefit, I think, of cultivating, we've talked about this before, is that it provides oxygen to your soil. It's going to remove that crust and kind of aerate the soil. And this is, man, if you get a hard rain and as soon as it relatively dry, you go out there and cultivate beside them plants, you can watch them pop.
You know, everybody knows that plants love carbon dioxide. They take carbon dioxide and they make oxygen out of it. That's the process there. But these roots actually have to have a certain amount of oxygen.
Yeah, and the bacteria down there like oxygen as well. You don't want to have an anaerobic soil environment, for sure. The third reason I think it's important to have some level of cultivation is that when you're composting or adding manure, and I've seen this firsthand in my dream garden, when you're composting or adding manure, you're amending prior to planting. That compost and that manure is going to work so, so much better if it's incorporated into the soil as opposed to just putting it right on top of the soil.
Yeah, especially manures.
You got to get them mixed
that
in.
That process, good. That exchange gets going over there, converting over, it works so much better when it's incorporated in and you have the right amount of moisture in there and you got a little warm weather. Boom.
The fourth one here, and this is a big biggie for me, the reason I don't like the kind of back to Eden style, nothing against it, just the reason I don't do it, is that I don't have to plant everything by hand. Now, if there was a garden plot that had wood chips all over it or wheat straw all over it, and I want to plant corn there, want to plant me a bed of greens there.
Well, I just got me a little bit of elephant garlic. Woo-wee! Yeah. That's pretty good. It's a little spicy there.
But I would have to plant that by hand. I would have to rake away the straw or something at, or plant into the straw by hand. Whereas the way we do it, we can use a seeder. We can make it a lot quicker process. And then the fifth one, which we talked about a minute ago, is that by cultivating, we can turn over beds or pots much, much quicker. We don't have to go in there. We do pull a lot of the plants. We will pull them out of the garden and remove them. I will do that with squash and other stuff. But other crops, smaller crops, greens, stuff like that, I might just turn those in. With cover crops, you know, if you're doing no-till and you're trying to get rid of a cover crop, you're going to need a lot more time if you're not going to actually till it in. If you're using a tarp or something to naturally break that down, that's a much more time-consuming process versus cultivating or turning in the soil.
So the big question is, which is best?
Which is best? I always say it just depends on your scale. I'm not here to bash either one.
I will tell you this, if you got a small garden and you want to grow a few vegetables and you're limited on the equipment or tools you have, it takes less equipment and tools to do the no-till garden because basically all you need is a couple handheld hoes or some kind of weeding thing or very little.
Right. So it depends on your scale. You know, I would say if you're just doing a 20 by 20, it's probably not a terrible idea.
I'd say that's getting a little bit on the big side. 20 by 20, I'd say probably smaller than that.
10 by 10, yeah. 15 by 15.
So I got to tell a little story. About 15 years ago, I was reading a lot about gardening and things like that and what to do. And I read this book talking about no-till gardening. And it really struck me. And it talked about all these issues here. So I said, well, I'm going to try something and see if this works for me. So what I did in the fall of the year, I laid my garden out. Back then, I didn't have it broken up in plots. I just gardened in one big spot. But I laid my garden out in the fall of the year, exactly why I wanted to plant it in the springtime. And I planted my whole garden in clover. Then I went back and just as soon as that clover come up, and I tilled the areas where I wanted to plant. So what we did was strip till. So I had it laid out perfect. It was beautiful. Clover was up this high. The bare dirt was there in the middle, and I knew I was going to plant it. So come springtime to plant, I had it ready. So I go out there and I plant in those strips. I couldn't manage it. My clover got too big, and I didn't have anything to crimp it down with or to kill it off with. I couldn't kill it off. Weeds come up there, and it was pretty much a failure. And this is my, after I got through with this experiment, I kind of sat down and kind of evaluated where I was at. Here's the problem. In a perfect world, this no-till thing works wonderful. It works wonderful
in some climates.
In a perfect world. In a non-perfect world where you have things that you have to change and adapt to, the tilling part of it works a lot better. Another thing, if you want, if you're out there for strictly producing and turning over and growing vegetable stuff, you cannot beat the till method that we do of growing on flat land and cultivating and putting drip irrigation. That's the most productive method they are out there, hands down. It's quicker, there's a little more work to it, but if you want production, that's the way to go. If you're not exactly crazy about production, you got a little bit to play with, some of the no-till stuff may work for you. But if you're out there and want bang for your buck, there's nothing compares to the method we have.
Another point talking about which is best, like I said earlier, it depends a lot on your climate. I have found that it doesn't work as well down here in the Deep South. I know Cog Hills tried it. I know Deep South, they did a little video series where they tried. Folks, down here we got these things called fire ants. And fire ants loved undisturbed areas. So if you were to put you some wood chips or something on the garden, you are creating some prime habitat for fire ants and termites. So here in the South, because we have those things that just thrive on undisturbed areas, when you do a back to Eden kind of style garden, you create some pretty big problems there.
And plus, our organic matter burns up in the soil so much quicker than people up north is. I mean, you take soils in Alaska and Ohio, up in Michigan, up there, they're a lot higher in organic matter. They're a lot easier to manage than the soils we have. We're just in a different situation here in the South than they are up there. And I've never gardened up there, so I can't tell you what to do. I can tell you what works for us down here.
Right, and also, down here, we have insect eggs and fungal spores and stuff that can overwinter in the soil because it doesn't get very cold. Whereas up north, it snows, gets cold enough to kill those things. And so the cultivation, tilling at least once a year pre-spring helps disrupt some of those pest and disease cycles that we could otherwise have pretty big problems with.
I ate that whole bowl.
You sure did. Talking about the climate, a lot of people will refer to the guy named Charles Dowding, which is in England, as kind of one of the pioneers of this no-till thing. And if you watch his YouTube videos, he has a beautiful garden that he does the whole kind of no-till thing. What you have to remember is his climate is completely different than most of ours. He's in England, which is latitudinally above Maine. It's way on up there. So it's a completely different growing world where he is. Lots of different disease and pest pressures. So it's not really comparable. The last thing there is it's going to depend, we said it's going to depend on your scale, it's going to depend on your climate, it's also going to depend on your resources. I don't have a good source for wood chips if I wanted to use them in the garden. Do you have a good compost source? Going to depend on what you have available to kind of what style of garden you might do.
Yep.
So tell us in the comments below there, what do you prefer? Do you like no-till? Do you like cultivate the garden, and why do you like each one? There's not a right or wrong answer there. Like we said, everybody's got their own way of doing things, and we appreciate that.
Yeah.
As long as we're all growing our own food, that's all that matters. So, we've got a few questions from last week's show.
Question time.
And if we answer your question on the show, send us an email to cusserve@hosttools.com. We'll send you a nice little prize.
Ooh, Shelly has got a question for you, but Shelly's got a tough last name. I'm gonna need a little help with.
Sometimes I might intentionally give you these tough names.
Shelly Hinojosa.
Hinojosa, maybe, I don't know.
Hinojosa. Shelly Hinojosa wants to know, when weeding in the garden for light to moderate weed pressure using a long handle tool, do you use the chop and drop method of cleaning up, leaving those weeds to compost naturally, or do you go to the trouble of picking them up and disposing of the weeds that you have disturbed?
That's a really good question. And I would say it depends on the weed. Now, if I've got some pigweed issues, a lot of times I'm going to go pull those pigweeds and I'm going to throw them out of the garden, because those things go to seed real, real quick. It depends on how easily they re-root. In the cooler months, I get this weed called purslane. And it's like a
sucker. Purslane or purslane?
I think it's purslane, purslane.
We'll go with that.
But it's like a succulent, and you can flip it over.
It is purslane. I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah, but you can flip it over whatever, and it doesn't decay in the sun because it's just so drought tolerant, and it's hard to get rid of. So a lot of times I have to throw that out of the garden. Now, if it's some small grassy weeds, tiny weeds, a lot of times, and if it's hot enough outside, the flipping of them, you know, whether it be with a wheel hoe or the long handle hoe, just flipping them over, they'll die in a couple hours, no big problem. So if they've gone to seed, I try to get them out of there. Or if there's some of those like succulent type weeds that just won't die, I'll get them out of there. For the most part, I just flip them and let the sun kill them. What say you?
I say that's a good plan.
Number two, Kathy Taylor says, last year was the first year I have had squash bugs. How do you control them without chemicals?
Wow, we get this question a lot. People really battle with squash bugs. Sanitation is your number one defense against squash bugs. Make sure you keep a good, clean garden, and when those plants are over with, get them out of there. The very worst thing you can do is when you squash and cucumbers and everything get through, is just forget about your garden and just lay it, because that's a haven for...
Have you a burn pile.
Have you something, get them out of there. Pumpkins, they love pumpkins. Man, they love pumpkins.
Yeah.
And pumpkins are a long-term crop and they can just wreak havoc. The weird thing is the eggs or the small nymphs of squash bugs are killed by freeze. So when you have a hard winter in the wintertime and you got a nice clean garden so they have nothing to hide under, you can actually, you get a hard freeze, it actually helps with your population of squash bugs. Keep that dirt turned. Good sanitation, grow some cover crops, keep that soil alive, keep it turned, and just keep everything nice and clean and tidy. Now, if you do want to spray, which you didn't ask for, but I'm going to tell you anyway, hit them babies early with some neem or spinosad or whatever, but you got to get them in the nymph stage, and you got to get them before you think you got a problem, and that'll help you a lot. But once those babies get to be adults, there ain't a whole lot you can do for them.
Yeah, and if you're totally against spray, and I do got a video out there, I think it was a 2-minute tip, I showed a little trick. Take your fingers, take you some duct tape, and wrap the sticky side sticking out around your fingers, and you can lift it. You can do this on a small scale. If you've got 100 row feet of squash, you probably don't want to do it. But if you lift them leaves up, look on the underside, you can see those little bunches of those copper-colored eggs. You can take that duct tape, and you can pick up those eggs and get them out of there. That can help you control the population. I always tell them, if you see any squash bugs, it kind of makes a citrusy, weird smell. But if you see them, I grab them and I smash them. Try to kill as many as I see.
So Southern Grace Homestead wants to know why we are new to y'all's channel and we are loving it. Well, thank you so much. Are zucchini and squash best done by transplants or direct sow?
I would say it just depends on where you live. This was the first year I had ever transplanted my winter squash, and with those South Anna butternuts I did, and man, that worked fabulously.
Boy, so, 10 years ago I'd have told you there ain't no way you could do that.
And it's got me thinking about transplanting some summer squash. As easy as they germinate in the soil, my only thing is I'm bad about planting them too deep. I will do it every year. I'll get excited and I'll plant me around them. I'll plant them too deep and have to go replant them. So that way I don't have to worry about them planting them too deep and replanting. So you could do them either way. I have found they work pretty good from transplants. Just don't let them get too root wrapped there. If you live in a warm enough climate where you don't have to worry about soil temp, you know, direct seeding is fine. If you live in a cooler climate, you might consider transplanting.
If you got warm, moist dirt, most of the time they pop pretty quick.
Yeah. Last one here is from Cody Way. And he says, the guy that Deep South mentioned multiplying onions a while back, could you give info on how and when to get a permanent bed of them started? What variety would work best for 7B?
Cody, I'm still learning about these multiplying onions, and I've grown them for a while, years back. But I'm still learning. First of all, you really don't have a permanent bed. You kind of have to dig them when it gets nice, hot in the summertime, and then put them in the barn, and you plant them back in the fall. So you have probably about 6 or 7 months of them growing, maybe 8 if you're in zone 7, but you can't hardly leave them out year round, and there's a couple of different reasons for that. You want to grow them out, dig them, store them, and then plant them again. I have not found the optimal time to dig them yet. I'm working on that. I've got some trials going. I'm still learning. Here where we at, I'm pretty sure you want to plant them in November, October, anytime there, maybe even the end of September's kind of hot, but
late
October, November, I think you can plant them. As far as digging them, I'm taking some notes and making some observations on when the best time to dig them. So I'm still learning, got mine growing, keeping some pretty good records out there. So when I know more, I'll tell you more, but that's kind of where I'm at right now.
You still in the learning phase.
And I'll be honest with you, I've had some trouble with my elephant garlic this year. I noticed a lot of people on row by row have too, with it not bubbling up like it has in the past. I don't think we had enough cold weather this time.
Might not have. Now, I hadn't pulled none of mine and checked.
I pulled some of mine, and I just didn't have the bub that I thought it should have, and it didn't look like I thought it should. So I'm wondering, you know, last year we had more cold, and my elephant garlic did a lot, but I'm just wondering if we didn't have enough to make that bub do right.
It'd still eat, though.
Oh, it'd still eat, but it's just not the best crop I've ever grown.
Right. All right, so we appreciate you guys sending those questions. As always, put your questions in the comments there, and we'll be glad to answer them on next week's show. I did want to go over the answers to our big giveaway we did last week. We had 3 people get it pretty quick. So the question we asked, how many years and days are we apart? It was 20 years, 20 days. What year was we Hoss Tool started? I said it was an even number. 2010 would be the correct answer there. The new heirloom squash we're growing for seed crop is called Algonquin.
I still have trouble
with
that.
Some people, there was this one we hadn't grown before. So it wasn't the Cherokee 10 because we have grown that one before. But Algonquin is the new one we're growing.
And by the way, it's growing like crazy.
Yeah. I've been meaning to do a video. I know you don't have time, but go out there to your garden and kind of give everybody an update what's going on and check on those.
Yeah.
The fourth one we asked, what was the most viewed row by row episode? It was that one where you gave all your watermelon tips recently. And then the name of your favorite pickling book is called
Pickle Pantry.
The Pickle Pantry, that's right. All right, so we appreciate everybody participating in that. And thank y'all for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed the show. Y'all have a good one.
Take care.